Today is Wednesday, May the 29th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. T-Mobile is raising prices on some of its older plans. Starting with your next bill, those on older plans can expect a $2 or $5 per line increase with notifications to affected customers going out. T-Mobile has avoided rate hikes for older plans the last few years, but that's now set to change. In a memo sent to employees, the company says it will start sending out notifications to some customers whose charges will increase starting with their June or July bills. The memo was sent out doesn't list which plans are affected, but says that those on the carrier's latest assortment of Go 5G plans will not see their prices increase. The same goes for millions of customers who are covered by T-Mobile's price lock guarantee, which will continue to be in effect for those people. T-Mobile is raising prices on older plans for the first time in nearly a decade, and that the increases are designed to keep up with rising inflation and costs. It isn't known exactly how many people will be affected by the change. The note says that it will affect a small portion of T-Mobile customers. The company expects to notify all affected customers on T-Mobile previously tried to move customers on older, generally cheaper plans to some of its newer, pricier ones last year, only to back off the plan amid backlash. Whereas with that move, people had the option to call T-Mobile support and push back against the change. A source familiar with the company's plan says that this option won't be available with this new rate hike. People affected by the price hike will be able to call up to change their plans to newer T-Mobile offerings, but they won't be able to opt out of this increase. The plans that were included with last year's experimental migration included T-Mobile's older one, Simple Choice, Magenta, and Magenta 55 Plus options. The announcement of a price hike comes amid increasing talk from the company that was looking to raise prices. Just last week at the Moffitt Nathanson Media and Communications Conference, T-Mobile's chief financial officer hinted that an increase was coming. As part of its merger with Sprint, which was completed in 2020, T-Mobile was legally required to not raise prices for 3 years. That period ended last year, and the carrier has since introduced its Go 5G assortment of plans, Go 5G, Go 5G Plus, and Go 5G Next. These plans have some new features, but they're also pricier than T-Mobile's earlier offerings. The carrier still allows new customers to sign up for older or cheaper plans like Magenta, Magenta Max, and Essentials. But some of these plans, namely the Magentas, are buried on its websites, and you'll have to call in or chat with T-Mobile support if you want to sign up. Even the Just Fine Magenta and Magenta Max options today requires heading to T-Mobile's plan page, clicking to see more available plans, then clicking on the link to learn more about Magenta and Magenta Max plans. In a recent report, Finland-based research firm Rewheel as spotted by Light Reading, found that since the T-Mobile Sprint merger, the U.S. wireless market has become one of the most expensive mobile markets in the world. While this move has been the first price hike from T-Mobile, its rivals have already made multiple increases to their respective plans over the last couple of years. AT&T raised rates for its latest plan by 99 cents early this year and has gone through other rate increases for older plans. Verizon has similarly gone through a bevy of price increases for its plans, most recently for those who were still on its older 5G Get More, Do More, Play More, and Start plans in February, after raising rates on some of its older unlimited plans last summer, while also adding in new fees for other older plans last year. As with other price increases, including seemingly T-Mobile's, Verizon's most recent move appeared to be designed to push people to switch to some of its newer and more expensive wireless plans. Competition comes to the laptop market. While Meteor Lake was the big step forward for Intel, a new competitor will give Intel a run for its money this year. Laptops powered by Qualcomm's ARM-based processors are set to arrive in June from all the major PC OEMs as well as from Microsoft itself. Previous attempts to bring the ARM architecture to Windows have failed miserably, but this time looks different. Qualcomm's new Snapdragon X Elite and Snapdragon X Plus processors are fast and efficient. While full benchmarks of Qualcomm's powered devices aren't yet available, early benchmarks indicate that the Elite X often outperforms Meteor Lake and even Apple's M3 chip in CPU-heavy tasks. The Elite X chip reigns supreme in AI workloads thanks to its powerful AI processor, running circles around Meteor Lake. A software emulation layer will handle backward compatibility, keeping legacy Windows applications built for x86 processor run on Qualcomm-powered devices. Emulation always introduces a performance penalty, but Qualcomm's chips may be powerful enough for this penalty to be unnoticeable by end users. Qualcomm chips also enable significant improvements in battery life. Qualcomm claims that some laptops will be capable of delivering multiple days of battery life, although we'll have to wait for third-party reviewers to see if this claim holds water. Intel is a sleeping giant, though. Up until 2017 or so, when rival AMD began its comeback, Intel dominated the PC CPU market and had little reason to push the envelope. Chronic manufacturing delays didn't matter for years as its market share hovered in monopoly territory. Those days are now gone. And Intel under CEO Pat Gelsinger knows it. Not only is AMD gaining market share, but Qualcomm and eventually other ARM-based CPU companies are coming for the PC market. Less than a year after launching Meteor Lake, Intel plans to bring its successor to market. An extremely fast cadence for Intel considering all the improvements coming. Intel's Lunar Lake chips will start shipping to OEMs in the third quarter, early enough to ensure plenty of systems are available for the holiday season. Lunar Lake uses a similar disaggregated architecture as Meteor Lake. The CPU tile is expected to be manufactured using the Intel 20A process, although that hasn't been confirmed. The Intel 20A will bring a new transistor design and backslide power delivery, the latter of which can deliver meaningful efficiency gains. Foundry leader Taiwan Semiconductor won't have backside power delivery until 2026. Lunar Lake will come with a supercharged AI processor, more than tripling the AI compute capacity of Meteor Lake. Upgraded graphics will contribute more AI horsepower, and Intel's work on its AI software ecosystem could give it an edge. Intel can't afford to move slowly with the competition brewing in the PC CPU market. Meteor Lake chips are selling well, although capacity constraints are currently hindering sales. However, Meteor Lake may be outclassed by Qualcomm's new chips once they launch. Thankfully, Intel will have an answer before the end of the year with Lunar Lake. Intel may never be as dominant as it once was in the PC CPU market as ARM-based chips gain a foothold. But if the company can maintain its momentum and bring new architecture to market and new manufacturing processes online in quick succession, it can remain the market leader in the age of the AI PC. This is a note for the early technology adopters and bleeding-edge tech nerds. Take note of the following points. The RISC architecture will need more working RAM memory than CISC or ISA architecture to hold values as it loads each instruction, acts upon it, then loads the next one. The CISC architecture can execute one, albeit more complex instruction that does the same operation all at once directly upon memory. The same functional program on a RISC system may and probably will require more memory to store due to the division of operations, while a CISC system may reduce the program size and potentially require lesser memory cycles for execution, leading to differences in memory usage between the two architectures. Which means that if you're interested in a RISC-based system to run the same functional program, you will need much more RAM memory in your system. It's important to note that while emulators aim to make software run on different hardware, they are not always perfect representations of the original hardware, and as a result, they may not be able to perfectly replicate all aspects of the original system, leading to compatibility issues. In some cases, certain applications may require native drivers that are not provided in the emulation environment, leading to their inability to work at all in emulation. Overall, while emulators are powerful tools for running programs designed for different systems, there are instances where programs may not run successfully due to hardware, software, or configuration issues. So if you have mission critical or you have extremely important processes such as your business, term papers, thesis, and if you need a machine immediately, I would buy an Intel-based processor system. And until sometime at the end of the year, when all the early adopters have shaken down the system, I would hold off on purchasing a Qualcomm Windows system at this present time. China's largest chip maker, SMIC, is now number 3 foundry in the world, according to a report by Counterpoint Research. SMIC held a 6% market share in terms of global foundry revenue in the first quarter, up from 5% last year, overtaking Global Foundries and Taiwan's United Microelectronics Corporation. This places SMIC only behind Taiwan's semiconductor and South Korea's Samsung Foundry. SMIC's quarterly results surpassed market expectations, and the company secured the number 3 position in foundry revenue market share in the first quarter of 2024 for the first time as demand recovery begins in China. China's largest chipmaker, SMIC, is now the world's third largest foundry in terms of revenue in the first quarter, according to Counterpoint Research. State-backed SMIC, or Semiconductor Manufacturing International Company, held a market share of 6% in the first quarter, up from 5% last year. The report showed it overtook Global Foundries and Taiwan United Microelectronics Corporation. This places SMIC behind only Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company and South Korea's Samsung Foundry, which held 62% and 13% of market share in the first quarter, respectively. SMIC's quarterly results surpassed market expectations, and the company secured the number 3 position in the foundry revenue market share in the first quarter of this year for the first time as demand recovery begins in China. SMIC reported first quarter revenue was $1.75 billion, up 19.7% from a year earlier as customers stock up on chips. More than 80% of its revenue in the quarter were derived from customers in China, the firm said in its earnings report. In the second quarter, the Chinese firm expects revenue to increase by 5% to 2% from the first quarter on strong demand. China consumes nearly 50% of the world's semiconductor, as it is the biggest assembly market for consumer devices. SMIC is seen as critical to Beijing's hope of reducing dependence on foreign technology in its domestic semiconductor industry as the United States continues to curb China's tech power. To boost domestic manufacturing, Beijing has pumped billions of yuan into subsidies into its chip firms. SMIC has been the target of U.S. sanctions since 2020, where American businesses will be required to apply for a license before they can sell to SMIC, restricting its ability to acquire certain U.S. technology. It has also been unable to obtain the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, which only Dutch firm ASML is capable of making. Without EUV machines, SMIC cannot produce high-tech semiconductors on a large scale at lower cost. In a blow to U.S. sanctions, a breakdown of Chinese tech giant Huawei Mate 60 Pro smartphone launched last year revealed that it runs on a 7-nanometer chip made by SMIC. The smartphone also appears to support 5G connectivity despite U.S. attempts to cut Huawei from key technologies including 5G chips. However, SMIC still lags behind Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung Electronics. Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung started mass producing 7-nanometer chips in 2018 and currently produces 3-nanometer chips. The smaller the nanometer size, the more advanced and efficient the chip. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and all of the different things that revolve around it. And Mary had a good question, and this is a very recurring question. A lot of people ask this, and this shows some of the interest that people have for working at home. And Mary's question is this: how can I ensure that my home office setup supports my health and wellness? All right, so I've got four different items that I really look to for making sure that my own home office setup is doing exactly this. First up, invest in ergonomic furniture. All right, so I have a very nice chair. Look, you can go with one of these $100 specials off of Amazon. They're not going to be comfortable. They're not going to provide the proper lumbar support that you need. They're not going to be anywhere near what you need for 8 hours a day or more when you consider that, okay, for in my office, I have my work location, and then I turn, and then I have another computer, my personal computer. So I'm actually in this for far more than 8 hours a day. So I wanted something that was going to be nice, solid. It's going to handle my being flexible in it. I have to be able to slide around to turn it, just turn and use the other computer. And that is probably very top of the list. You want to make sure that your desk also is the proper height for you and for your working style. One of the things for health and wellness that we've talked about for a while is one of these sit-stand desks. So these desks where you reach on over and you can adjust that desk up higher if you want to stand, or down lower, and maybe fit this into a little bit more of your particular build. Someone who's shorter, you want to have your feet flat on the ground. So you may decide, okay, I need my chair a little bit lower, and my desk should be lower to match up with this. In my personal case, I managed to get away with this because a lot of the what I have in here is set up for my height. It's set up for me to be comfortable, for me to really deal with everything as I need to. I do not have a stand desk or a sit-stand desk at this time. I'm considering that. The biggest problem I've got is because I've got two different locations, technically three. I've got my Mac off to the other side. So I've got this U arrangement, work and then personal and then my Mac desk. So you've got to think about what the expense is going to be here, but it's actually important for you to determine how expensive you want to go. Still, it's a good idea. The chairs and desks that you find in the offices, if you go into the office, they're going to be far more expensive. Why? Because they don't want you to have injuries. They don't want you to have especially the long-term injuries like carpal tunnel and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different things that they're going to be looking at for you. And they do this across a very large amount, so they get some discounts. Still, invest in that ergonomic furniture. Also, you need to check your posture on a regular basis. Your computer monitor needs to be at eye level. You don't want to have it going up too high or down too low. Think about if you're experiencing neck strain, if you're having to hunch over, if you're leaning in too much for your location. So that means, yes, invest in that furniture. You know, the idea of, re-outfitting your bedroom and you sit on your bed. Well, you have no back support there. You sit on the couch in the living room. That's not really a home office. So you really want that separate location as well. You want a pleasant environment. Along with that, I want you to look around. I want you to see that your work environment at home isn't a disaster zone, but instead you've got plants around. You've got things that are important for you. In my office, I don't have any plants. We do have plants throughout the house, but I do have other things. I've had a long fascination with space. So some of the stuff up on my walls, I've got, you know, pictures of astronauts, big, huge, picture of Earth and things like that. It supports kind of my design ethic, if you, or not ethic, but, you get the idea, I hope. You want it to be someplace that you're going to be happy working in. So surround yourself with these kinds of things that make it inspiring for you and again, comfortable. Lastly, stay hydrated. And I want you to eat healthy. You've got to have water nearby. You've got to have nutritious snacks that are on hand. Let's say you've got a meeting that runs really long. It runs through your lunchtime. You've got to be able to reach on over and grab some, in my case, Lara bars, but, you know, granola bars, stuff like that, to stave off that hunger that you might feel at the wrong time. Make sure you've got plenty of hydration handy. That is, that's a key thing. A lot of people forget about that. So, yeah, grab one of those big, huge, well, you know, people are talking about the Stanley Cups. You don't have to do that. But grab something that's going to hold water, that's going to have water on hand for you all throughout the day. And look, you put these together and you're already moving in the right direction for health, comfort, wellness, and being able to really work through any different disruptions that may have passed your desk in the last few hours. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. ARM64 and AI are driving a great reset. There is a transformative force in the Windows PC industry, unlike any witness in the past three decades. Microsoft's Copilot Plus AI PCs result from a perfect storm of AI and Qualcomm's new processors, reshaping the entire Windows PC ecosystem. The emergence of a new Copilot Plus PCs stands out as a transformative force. Some have termed this as the Great PC Reset, which signifies the convergence of cutting-edge ARM64 processors from Qualcomm, powerful neural processing units, that's the NPUs, generative AI, and PC manufacturers rallying around the concept of the AI PC. It signifies a resurgence of fundamental computing principles and simplicity. This technology merger is poised to redefine our perception of Windows, marking a tectonic shift comparable to the emergence of the Internet. Qualcomm's strategic acquisition of Nuvia is a game changer. Qualcomm technically didn't design its own processors, but relied on existing designs by Arm Limited, which it then licensed and modified. Another significant hurdle was the chicken and egg problem with ARM64 compatibility. The lack of widespread adoption of Qualcomm-based Snapdragon laptops meant that software developers saw little incentive to recompile apps for ARM64. Luckily for Qualcomm, they stumbled upon a solution. In March of 2021, Qualcomm acquired for $1.4 billion a tiny startup named Nuvia. Qualcomm saw a different opportunity with its newly acquired talent. Gerald Williams III, Manu Gulati, and John Bruno weren't just ex-Apple engineers. They led development on Apple's A-series chips used in iPhones and iPads, which scaled up to the current M-series. They now work for and are designing in-house ARM64 processors for Qualcomm. If anyone doubts that Qualcomm could give Apple a run for its money in silicon, they're probably not paying attention to who is now working for Qualcomm. While it took 3 years to get to this point, in summer of this year, 2024, we'll finally see the results of Qualcomm's Nuvia acquisition, and they're nothing short of staggering. Qualcomm's new Snapdragon processors, in one fell swoop, will be bypassing Intel and AMD for power and efficiency, and besting Apple's best-selling M3 processor found in the popular MacBook Pro laptops. What wasn't planned was the meteoric rise of generative AI and the need for AI accelerators, or the NPUs. Luckily, Qualcomm also had an ace up its sleeve for that. When partnered with Microsoft's massive AI pivot, it will create the perfect storm of new, powerful, and long-lasting AI PCs. On November the 30th of 2022, OpenAI, a company few had ever heard of, released ChatGPT to the public. It had reached 1 million users just 5 days later, which was unprecedented. It was only 2.5 months later that Microsoft, who had partnered with OpenAI back in 2019 with a $1 billion investment, later it invested $10 billion in January of 2023 to enhance that partnership, got on stage in a hastily assembled media briefing to show off how ChatGPT can power Bing Search and Bing Chat, later rebranded to Microsoft Copilot. Even the new experimental Bing garnered over 1 million signups in only 48 hours. Microsoft's move was genius. It famously usurped Google's Gemini announcement weeks later, making Google look behind and wholly caught off guard, especially since everyone expected Google to be the AI leader, not Microsoft. Since February of last year, 2023, it has been a whirlwind for OpenAI and Microsoft. The latter has deployed Copilot across everything from GitHub to the web, its Edge browser, standalone applications for iOS and Android, and built it into Outlook, Office, and Windows 11 itself. However, one of the current problems with generative AI is processing. Until now, the large language models, otherwise known as LLMs, had to be housed on massive servers with just as massive GPUs to make the queries timely enough to be acceptable. But data still had to be uploaded and then downloaded from the user, adding latency, not to mention queuing for your query due to high user demand. Another problem is that general LLMs are good at inference for public data, but don't do much for personalized data, whether for the individual or the corporation, and not to mention privacy and security concerns. That's where localized and private 7 billion parameter LLMs and so-called small language models become relevant. Companies can now invest in AI factories, which provide everything from powerful servers to the laptops needed to create, train, run inference, and deploy LLMs based on internal company data. When combined with cloud-based search data, this so-called hybrid AI approach takes generative AI to a new level. This is why enterprises are so enamored with AI. Private LLMs can act like an AI genie for a company, like a universal secretary, knowledgeable in company-specific data documents, training guides, and resources, making them potentially invaluable assistants to employees instead of glorified web search engines. However, having an AI accelerator or neural processing unit, the NPU, to run these systems on a laptop is critical. Think of an NPU like a CPU and GPU. Instead, it is optimized to run AI data efficiently and speedily. Sure, you can game on a laptop without a discrete GPU, but having one is better. The same applies to running AI. Intel's latest Core Ultra processors, the Meteor Lake, run 11 trillion operations per second, which is also known as TOPS, which helps with things like Windows Studio effects, background blurring, gaze correction, etc., but would choke on 7 billion parameter LLMs, which are the threshold for generating high-quality outputs, rivaling human-generated content. AMD and Apple also have NPUs on their chips. Apple's new M4, currently only in the new iPad Pro, hit 38 TOPS, up from just 18 TOPS in M3, while AMD's latest Ryzen chips still fall below 20. But Qualcomm's new Snapdragon X Elite Plus chips hits 45 TOPS, making them the most potent NPUs in any laptop. Intel will reach this second generation NPU level later this year with its Lunar Lake chips. But Qualcomm is now king, and laptop makers, Microsoft, and software developers have noticed. Toss in Microsoft's advancements like Windows 11 ReCore and AI Explorer, which for now is exclusively Snapdragon X laptops, and you have the first genuine AI PC, or as the industry calls them, Copilot plus PC. Microsoft is releasing the first true AI operating system, putting itself ahead of Apple and Google, which are trying to catch up. However, Microsoft can only do this because Qualcomm has a chip that can process AI to make it happen. Without that 45 TOPS NPU, this whole thing falls apart, which is why, for now, Intel and AMD laptops aren't getting these features. Windows on ARM. ARM processor devices have been around for a while now. ARM architecture has been around since 1990, with ARM originally standing for Acorn RISC machine, founded as a joint venture for Apple, Acorn Computers, and VLSI. These days, the company stands on its own as ARM Limited. ARM is a name for a type of RISC, which is Reduced Instruction Set Computer. An ARM processor simplifies instructions for the computer to help a system run more efficiently. ARM processors tend to be less powerful than traditional CPUs, but they also require less power to run. Many companies choose to run with ARM-based processors in order to create lightweight devices with long battery life. ARM is based on a reduced instruction set computer. It's literally a type of computer architecture that simplifies instructions. ARM is different from other processors. CPUs from Intel and AMD are provided and placed inside OEM computers, manufacturers like Dell, Lenovo, and so on, as they are, without OEMs changing these processors. Intel and AMD designed their own x86 and x64 processors, which are core CPUs, but only Intel goes the extra step and makes them in its own factory, which is why Intel is so powerful. However, AMD relies on a company like Taiwan Semiconductor to make its chips. A company like Qualcomm or MediaTek purchases licenses from ARM Limited to use core design ARM CPU components and architecture. With these licenses, manufacturers can legally alter or adjust ARM architecture or connect an ARM processor to the chip. In other words, while Qualcomm goes on to design some of the system-on-a-chip component, the base of the processor comes from ARM Limited, which designed and licensed it. After the ARM chip is finalized by Qualcomm or MediaTek, it then goes on to a company like Taiwan Semiconductor to manufacture it. An ARM processor is called system-on-a-chip because it includes a CPU, GPU, and these days, an NPU, and things like 5G modem. In other words, these chips have multiple components on one board rather than just being a single CPU. ARM processors often aren't as powerful as CPUs either. However, ARM processors tend to require less power to operate, so devices using ARM processors tend to last longer before recharging. In the world of CPUs, the x86 and the x64 are the most common architecture types used with laptops. Meanwhile, ARM64 isn't as powerful as x86 or x64 architecture. Over the last few years, Apple has seen huge success with MacBooks and iPads, which use the company's M1, M2, M3, and recently announced M4 ARM chips. Meanwhile, Microsoft's Surface line of devices has also sold well with its XQ1, XQ2, and XQ3 ARM chips. But now, more Windows on ARM competitors are going up against macOS on ARM. For context, Windows software has traditionally been used on x86 and x64 processor computers. But lately, the far less power-hungry ARM system on a chip have proven to provide far more battery life than traditional CPUs for smartphones and laptops. In other words, putting Windows on ARM has allowed various manufacturers like Dell, Lenovo, and others to produce Windows laptops that offer good performance with longer-lasting batteries. ARM processors and devices might be getting a lot of attention lately, but this isn't a new technology. Rather than producing its own CPUs like AMD and Intel, ARM Limited sells licenses for core CPU components and ARM architecture design. Companies who purchase these licenses can then use these components and chip architecture legally to create more customized processors for their specific needs. ARM processors were used with devices like Nokia phones and Texas Instruments in the 90s, and then became the dominant architecture for touchscreen phones in the 2000s and 2010s. The reason companies continue to work with ARM is because this technology vastly improves battery life while offering balanced device performance. So you can see why smartphones and smaller devices that emphasize portability, like the Microsoft Surface line, utilize this kind of technology. Currently, the latest ARM architecture is ARM version 9, which was first introduced in 2021. Purchasing ARM licenses is how Apple made a big splash in 2020 by moving away from Intel's x86 chips in favor of creating its own ARM-based M1 chip. The M1 chip became associated with lightweight laptops with great battery life and decent performance. Since then, the company has gone on to build upon its M-series ARM silicon with M2 and M3 chips. The M-series Apple silicon, in some ways, share the same DNA as Qualcomm's Snapdragon X Elite, not only because they are both ARM processors, but because they were both initially developed by some of the same people. The thing is, you basically cannot talk about Apple ARM processors without bringing up Qualcomm. In 2019, a trio of former Apple employees, Gerard William III, Apple's former chief architect for iPhone chips, John Bruno, former system architect at Apple, and Manu Gulati, former lead system-on-a-chip architect at Apple, brought their knowledge of ARM processors with them and founded a new company called Novia. Here, the trio continued to build upon their designs outside of Apple's restrictions. They did so well that the semiconductor manufacturer Qualcomm acquired them in 2021. The M-Series Apple Silicon shares the same DNA as Qualcomm Snapdragon X Elite because they were both initially developed by some of the same people. The trio that left Apple have been able to produce ARM processors that are faster than Apple. Qualcomm's real competition, however, isn't Apple. It's actually AMD and Intel. And currently, Qualcomm is the biggest ARM processor competitor in the space. Intel was the biggest chip maker in the United States by far, but times have changed, with AMD providing strong CPU competition. But Qualcomm market value is actually currently a larger company than Intel. AMD and Qualcomm have spent the last years producing AI-boosting NPUs, that's neural processing units, to keep up with growing AI demand. Well, Intel only just entered the NPU market this year with its Intel Core Ultra line. Windows on ARM used to be rather limited, but that really isn't the case now. It used to be that drivers and programs often weren't compatible with ARM, but now most, if not all, of your apps will run with Windows on ARM laptops. The only exception to this could be smaller developers who haven't released ARM 64 drivers for this software. It is true that at one point, Windows on ARM was far more limited than on traditional Windows laptop because many programs didn't have ARM 64 extensions. However, this has changed through the years. These days, you can run most, if not all of your apps on a Windows on ARM device. Today, ARM devices can easily run Windows 10 and Windows 11. Both x86 and ARM have their merits, and so they will end up having different focuses as time goes on. Cleaning up browser extensions. Browser extensions are a way to enhance internet browsing, but some of them may be slowing down your system. Some can cause longer load times on websites, although it depends how data is processed. Certain ones are better than others. Extensions that process data before a page has rendered will have a much worse impact on user experience. VPNs seem to be among the worst of this, with some causing a full second of delay. It makes sense why load times would be particularly bad with a VPN as they route traffic through an intermediary server. Extensions that run their code after the page has been loaded can also impact browser efficiency, but to a seemingly lesser extent. Processing time can result in web page slowdown as the software strains the hardware, but not always. Extensions that run their code after page has loaded reduces page load speeds, but they run as soon as page starts loading. Even if an extension doesn't create slow load times, it may cause slow page interactions, meaning that clicking around on a website may not feel snappy. There isn't much you can do to remedy the issue. Fixing extensions ultimately falls on the developers who made them, but there are a couple of things you can do to help. So if you're a frequent browser user and experiencing a browser slowdown with extensions installed, uninstall unfamiliar extensions as they may have been added without your knowledge while you were surfing on the website. Uninstall extensions that are no longer needed or are dated for your use. Websites with tons of ads can directly cause a slowdown. Consider installing an ad blocker. Most ad blockers can improve your browsing experience. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
888. Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you know, we utilize various hand signals as we're recording. I tell you, we've got 3 minutes left, 1 minute left.
I thought that was a Boy Scout salute.
So it's interesting because you and I record over a great distance. What are we, about 800 miles apart from each other? Maybe 600, 700. I don't know, whatever it is.
Something farther than I want to walk.
Yes. But this is very much similar to a lot of what we deal with when we're dealing with the workplace. A lot of us.
Skype and WebEx and Zoom,
sure,
and Teams,
yeah,
and those,
yeah,
other evil,
exactly,
empires.
Yeah. Evil empires. So I wanted us to spend just a few minutes in regards to nonverbal communications.
And that's just the thing. You know, you get into those little postage stamp initial blocks that people hide behind in group meetings.
Yeah, yeah.
They can only – it's not even a talking head. It's just talk.
Very true.
I remember in psych class, they showed a video of a New York intersection.
Yeah.
So probably 500 people on each side, and it changes to walk. And you've got this throng of 1,000 people, half of them going in opposite directions.
Sure, yeah.
Not a single bump and not a single word. Mm-hmm. That was a vivid demonstration that more than 90% of all human communications is nonverbal.
Yeah, yeah, very true.
So here you are in Zoom, you're in Teams, and there's this picture or initial or whatever. Do you trust them? Is there anything? I mean, what are the facial cues? What's the body language? Is there direct eye contact? Look, most of those meetings look like a 2D version of a toddler's alphabet blocks, right?
Fair enough, yeah.
Not even faces, just initials. The most boring talking heads on cable TV, political bull session shows,
yeah,
communicate better because at least – you know, they offer more than just voices talking. Yeah, okay, this is radio, and that's all you get out of
it. It is. I was wondering where you're going, because all of a sudden people are going to tune off and head off to the TV near them.
But the issue, you know, what's missing? So it's really about how you can be wanting to be in a communications environment with so many people. And all you have is spoken voice. All you have is words. No intuition, a little bit of observation, but it's all in tonality.
Sure.
Right? So you have to learn to discover, rediscover, in fact, that it's human nature to look at eyeballs.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I reviewed this product a while back, but I've continued. This is one of the products I continue to use. Something called the Center Cam. Instead of it is a great little device because I'll tell you, I'm looking at my screen when I'm dealing with whether it's web conferencing or all of the different things that are going on.
How does that one work? Does it flow it in the middle of your monitor?
Yes, it does.
So you're hiding some of your monitor to make it work.
An ever so small amount.
I get that.
It's not too shabby.
How could you do it on a phone, right? How could you do it on a tablet or a notebook? It would be tough.
Sure,
The challenge there is that the camera is never dead center. You've got one, but almost never out.
Almost never, yeah. Yeah. There have been discussions of screens that are going to hide the camera behind the pixels. And
LG came out with that transparent OLED display.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
About the cost of a used car. And
yes.
I want to go back in time a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
When artists started painting, they started painting pictures. When photography started. And pictures happened when video, when film first started. People discovered that eyes are the glue for eyes. Eyes on a picture, eyes on a poster, eyes on a screen, eyes on a canvas, whatever it is. You've never, ever seen a pinup or beefcake poster that didn't show the eyes looking back at you. Your choices about people, friendliness, nastiness, understanding, disinterest, they tend to have a lot to do with eye contact, facial cues, body language, that stuff. All those nonverbal communicators. And for those online meetings, oh boy, even if your camera is on, eye contact is hard because the camera's almost never where you're looking at the screen.
Sure. Yeah, there is a bit of that.
You know, it's somewhere else. So I think we're going to need to get better at all this. I think there's going to be a change later this year in ways that are there. But for now, hey, raise your glass. Here's not looking at you.
And it's kind of funny because I provided you a 2-minute notice and a 1-minute notice.
Yeah.
And even right now, so I'm looking over, I'm looking at you on the screen, not up at the camera there. You're looking at the screen, me on the screen, not at the camera.
Yeah.
So.
Let me shift that. I'll move the screen.
There you go. Sure. There's a lot to this, and I want to encourage everybody out there. Try to engage more with that camera instead of the picture, the person who's on the other side of the camera, or even worse, some of those people who look at themselves. That whole narcissistic, oh, hey, what do I look like on camera? Yeah, you've been doing it for the last however long since COVID started.
Is there wind? Is my hair lifting from the back?
I don't have that problem. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, June the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, June the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation, Digital Forensics for Fun and Profit, presentation by Dr. Rebecca Mercury. Thursday, June the 13th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, June the 14th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting, website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect, Thursday, July the 11th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is wpcug.org. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.